Hello, you're listening to Sending the Experts with Georgina Durrant. This podcast is all about teaching and supporting children and young people with special educational needs and disabilities, SEND. My name is Georgina Durrant. I'm the host of this podcast brought to you by Twinkle SEND. As a former teacher in Senko myself, I wanted to create a platform to share some of the amazing things that my guests are doing to support learners with SEND. So whether you're listening on your commute, tuning in whilst walking your dog, or curled up on the sofa with a nice cup of coffee, in this episode, I am delighted to be joined by Andrea Cartwright. Andrea works as a practice and innovation developer in the product and innovation team at Thrive and is a fully licensed Thrive trainer. Thrive is a former sensitive approach, and we've covered it before on the podcast. A key part of her role is to research, write, and develop content to inform practice and training. And as a former deputy principal, Andrea has worked with all ages of students across early years, primary, and secondary school. She's a qualified special educational needs coordinator who, alongside working for Thrive, also works in the specialist secondary school and sixth form, supporting neurodiverse young people with an education healthcare plan for communication and interaction needs alongside social, emotional, and mental health needs. Wow, that's a lot. Hiya, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you. Really pleased to be here.
We've previously had a very popular episode with Thrive. If you've not heard it before, please check back and have a listen to it, because I think it's probably our most popular episode on the podcast so far. And we did all about communication, behaviour being communication, and the importance of understanding the background behind why someone is behaving in a certain way. So can you explain to us, Andrea, what Thrive is and the reason Thrive is so passionate about trauma-sensitive approaches?
Yeah, so Thrive offers a trauma-informed whole school or setting approach to improving the mental health and wellbeing of children and young people. And trauma-informed practice is an approach grounded in the understanding that trauma exposure can impact an individual's development. So at Thrive, we do that by training, and we also have a profiling and action planning tool, which we call Thrive Online. Mm-hmm. So the training courses and Thrive Online help adults to better understand the needs of pupils and provide targeted support and measure impacts as well. So our vision is all about raising the awareness of the importance of supporting children and young people's social and emotional development and how to do this. And we work with lots of different sectors. So we work with early years, schools, academies, specialist schools, MATs, local authorities, international schools. We're lucky enough to work with a whole host of different sectors. That's Thrive.
Yeah, brilliant. And so in this episode, we're going to talk about isolation and the use of isolation booths in schools, because it's a really topical issue. Lots of people aren't happy, understandably, about isolation booths, but then there's the other side that a lot of schools are saying, well, what do we do without them? How do we manage behave? I know it's a tricky one to explain, but how do we help these children who are dysregulated to manage them in the classroom when they're behaving in certain ways that aren't appropriate? And how can teachers manage a class of 30 children if you've got somebody who is very dysregulated in the classroom? And so, yeah, there's a lot, and there's a lot to unpack here with it. Can you just briefly explain to us what an isolation booth is and when they are being used?
So typically, isolation booths are environments where pupils might be sent to if, like you say, if they're deemed to be behaving inappropriately. It might be through the day. It can be short term or long term. It might be, you know, just for a certain session. They might be in there all day. And typically, isolation booths are kind of small, three-sided structures that are kind of enclosed, that pupils sit and tend to face the back of the wall, usually in silence. And it's not just isolation booths. Some schools or settings might use isolation rooms where they might have individual desks that they sit in if they've been removed from the classroom.
Yeah,
so that's the experience of them.
Yeah, all of the secondary schools I've taught in have had these either isolation rooms, like you say, where a room where the children would go to.
Yeah.
Secondary children would go to if they were causing disruption in the lesson, I suppose, and they were sent to these rooms. Or there was like say these isolation booths, and I've seen it. There was a big school I worked in where they had these isolation booths, and it was like a desk, so desks all around one wall, if you like, of the room. Like an L-shaped round, and then sort of partitioned off with I don't know what the material is, but partitioned off at the sides, so they're all in these separate booths that were supposed to stay in for a long period of time. So are we finding it's just in secondary school? Because I've only experienced it personally in secondary schools. Is that what you're finding, or are we hearing of primary schools using them?
I think the same. So in my experience, I've known lots of secondary schools and provisions use them. However, yeah. I've known that primaries do as well. And I think it's becoming more popular, if you like, with much younger children, whereas I think previously we might have only seen it in with older students in secondary. I do think some primary schools are also using using them as well. That in my experience.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting to know if anyone's listening and is in a primary school that uses them or is aware of primary school. It'd be interesting to know the reasons behind that. So if we're thinking of this from the child's point of view, because I know Thrive is all about thinking about things from, you know, from the child's point of view, as we should, what's going to be the impact on a child, in your opinion, if they are isolated from their peers in such a way? If they've been in the class, they've not been managing their emotions and dysregulated in some way, and their behaviour isn't how somebody wants it to be, and then causing some disruption perhaps, they're making the lesson difficult for the teacher, they're making it difficult for their peers, and they've been sent out of the classroom, isolated away from their peers for a large proportion of the day. How does that help them? How do you think it impacts on them?
So we know that humans have got an innate drive for connection from, you know, from the moment that we're born. What we're doing is we're trying to connect in with others, and we've got that drive for attachment and connection. And we know that relationships are vital to our mental well-being. You know, they create positive, supportive relationships with others, and it helps to prevent things like, you know, stress, anxiety, isolation, loneliness. And if what we're doing is we're taking children, young people away from that, actually we're creating that barrier. And if we're taking children away from their peers, we're impacting on their mental health, because humans are social beings. And if we're depriving children of that social interaction for extended periods, that can have effects on their mental well-being. You know, and it can lead to, you know, feelings of shame. So, you know, if you're always a student that's, you know, getting sent out or sent to isolation, you know, it's that feeling of shame. It can lead to things like bullying from others, becoming isolated from their peer groups. You know, if you're in isolation, when it's break time, dinner time, social times, and you're not there for that, you're missing those social interactions, the relationships, and, you know, the opportunity to connect with others is, you know, that's gone. And I think as well, not just the impact of being away from peers, but actually their education, you know. Yeah. They're not in the classroom, they're missing out on that, you know, the expert in the room, that vital teaching. And obviously often in the isolation rooms or booths, there'll be an adult that may or may not be a teacher to support with the work they've been sent, but they're typically aren't the expert in that field. You know, they're not the maths expert or the science expert. You know, they're away from the resources that they need. And that leads to, you know, them falling further behind with their education. It's difficult if they're constantly in, you know, isolation and away from the classroom. It's harder to reintegrate them back into the classroom, back into the lesson, which just makes those gaps, you know, bigger and bigger. So yeah, it has a huge, huge impact.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I was just reflecting when I used to teach science in secondary, if somebody had to go to isolation and then you sent them the work, often they wouldn't be able to access the work. It's very difficult for some lessons, especially the practical base. They need the input from the teacher. They need the input from the practical session of that of that lesson. And then how are they expected? And often they're the ones that are struggling with the actual content of the lesson anyway. Yeah. And then they're expected to sit in isolation with a worksheet or a textbook. And, you know, you knew it wasn't going to come back a high quality amount of work, even if they were sat there with it, they'd be struggling. And like you say, the adult in the room is very unlikely to be a specialist in the subject of the piece of work they've got. Yeah. They could be like a cover supervisor. They could be somebody else that, you know, hasn't got the specialist of that subject. So it's going to massively impact on education, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, if you've missed, you know, lessons move really quick. So if you've missed a key chunk of learning, then you're coming back into something that you think, I don't understand what we're doing. You know, everyone's moved on and they've kind of left you behind because you weren't there for that bit of teaching, especially if, you know, if you're in there for, you know, 2 days, 3 days, that's, you know, three full lessons. That's a huge chunk of learning that you've potentially missed, that you then, you know, when do we make that up? When do we, you know, bridge the gaps between that? And it can, like you say, it's harder to reintegrate back into that lesson, which is likely to lead to dysregulation, you know, behavior incidents, which then kind of starts the cycle all off again with back in isolation.
Imagine being that student that comes back into the class after having been isolated. They now don't understand, they were struggling before perhaps, they now don't understand where you're up to at all, and I'm expected to be able to continue. It's impossible. But then again, from the teacher's point of view, it's really difficult because there isn't time in a packed timetable realistically to catch all these kids up on the, it's a really tricky one, isn't it? Because you know, I've been there and I get how tricky it is for the teachers on the ground who are working, you know, you've got five periods in a day of work, of lessons, and trying to catch those kids up who've been in isolation. You've given them the work, they've disrupted your lesson, you're trying your best. It's really hard. I also wondered, you know, when you were saying about the impact on the child and like their self-esteem and all of that, when they've been isolated, it's almost a bit like when you put, you know, like the whole putting a toddler on the naughty step, and how that we've been a lot of research saying that doesn't work now. Idea that separating them from you when they actually need you the most isn't helpful.
Absolutely. And it's relationships, that's the key thing, and it's having that attuned adult alongside, because what happens is when children are dysregulated or if they're heightened, they often don't know how to regulate themselves. They might not be able to explain how they're feeling or why they're feeling, and often they don't know, like say, how to regulate themselves, so they might do things and behave inappropriately because they don't actually know how to deal with that big feeling. So actually separating them from the adult, that's the person they need the most. So, you know, it's without an attuned adult alongside, they're going to struggle to understand cause and effect. They're not going to shift that feeling into thinking. So, you know, they're going to struggle to think, you know, feel in a certain way and think, right, this is what I need to do. You know, do I need to have a 2-minute brain break? Do I need to go and get my fidget? Do I need to, you know, have a walk to the toilet and come back again? Without that adult to support that, that's really difficult. So in Thrive, we have things called vital relational functions. And it represents the key techniques that we use to apply in relationships. So, you know, if a child is dysregulated, it's attuning, you know, attunement. So matching their energy, you know, noticing what they're doing and attuning to how they're feeling, and then validating, you know, acknowledging how they're feeling. You know, it's okay to feel like that. We all have these feelings. That's normal, you know, and not kind of brushing it aside that it's not normal, because often then children think, oh, it's, you know, it's not all right to feel angry. It's not okay to feel, you know, like that, because it is. We all feel like that's part of life. That's part of human nature. And it's acknowledging and giving validity to those feelings that the child's experiencing, and then containing it. So you're the supportive adult alongside. So providing predictability, routine, you're the security and the safety for that child. And then regulations are helping them regulate. So, you know, what can we do to you know, bring you back down and get you ready to be back into maths? Do we need to have a quick walk around the playground? You know, do you need to go and do a sorting activity? Do you know, just to get them back, you know, to reduce their cortisol and get them in a calm state, ready to go into science, go into maths, go into English. So the adult is absolutely that key, is the key person in that, to be alongside and not isolate them. Because when that happens again, when they come back into maths and they get dysregulated again, they're going to be stuck. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to regulate or how to deal with those feelings. And when we're just dismissing it and sending them to isolation or out of the classroom, not, you know, we're missing that learning opportunity. Absolutely.
And I suppose as well, I remember last time I spoke to your colleagues at Thrive, they were saying as well about like developmental age as well, because we often think of students at secondary school as being able to sort of regulate their own emotions, think about strategies themselves for self-regulation. But if they're developmentally a lot younger, as we might have with some of our children with SEND or children who've experienced, you know, adverse childhood experiences, then surely they're going to be more like needing co-regulation level rather than being able to self-regulate their emotions.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, just like with anything, with reading, with, you know, any kind of subject, it's the same with social and emotional development. Children and young people and adults can have gaps in their development. And like you say, if they have got gaps and earlier unmet needs, then they might struggle. And it might be that, you know, we're looking at a 15-year-old in a 15-year-old's body, but actually their social and emotional age might be 12 months, 6 months. Yeah. So when we're trying to expect them to regulate and behave in certain ways, and, you know, and they've not been taught how to do that, and they've not had that attachment and those positive relationships, then they're going to really struggle to do that. And it's our job to help, you know, fill those gaps and help support them. And it takes time. You know, often, you know, when I talk to people, I train people, and they'll say, no, I did it once, and we talked about it, and they said, yeah, we're going to do this next time, and then they did it again. And that's what will happen, because it takes repetition to build the neuronal pathways and to build those links. And, you know, it will take repetition of, you know, doing it over and over again and having those conversations until they can start to do it for themselves. But again, it's back to that. The adult is the key resource. And it's you that, you know, supporting them to do that each time is the way forward, and to help them to have that, again, that big feeling and know how to handle it and what to do and to be able to recognize, because we don't always do that with, you know, we talk about feeling sad or happy or angry. Actually, what does it feel like? You know,
it's difficult to make the connection between, they might be able to recognize a picture and say, oh yeah, that person is looking happy, but they don't know how it actually feels inside, and be able to recognize their own emotions. Yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, talking about when we feel angry, you know, what does it, and it's different for everybody, so it's you know, not assuming that we know how they feel, because we don't naturally, you know. It's wondering, I'm wondering if you're feeling like this, I'm imagining it's like this for you, I'm noticing, and you know, and giving your own experience, you know, saying, you know, when I feel angry, I feel it is tight in my stomach, feels really tight, I get really hot, my hands might clench and they get sweaty, and talking about what it physically feels like, and putting names to that. So, you know, this is what it feels like for me when I'm feeling disappointed, when I'm feeling overwhelmed, and using words, because like we say, if they've not been taught that, they won't know it.
Absolutely. And I suppose learning from us as well, strategies like, you know, you spill your coffee whilst you're teaching, not just pretending you're absolutely fine about it, but you could, you know, obviously don't shout and scream and cause a big fuss, but you could explain, you could narrate it, couldn't you? And be like, oh gosh, I'm feeling so frustrated that I just spilt my only coffee of the day. I'm just going to take a minute to myself and take some breaths, and then I'm going to come back to this because I'm feeling a little bit cross or something, just so kids can see that adults also have emotions and how we deal with them, and what strategies we're using, I suppose, because they learn so much from watching us, a lot more than I think we realize, even teenagers.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting you say that, because one of the things I was thinking about is, you know, when we've got an adult that's disregarded, you know, so thinking about, you know, we've got to school in the morning, Georgina, and you arrive and, you know, you look a bit flustered, you're a little bit late, you've run in, you've kind of thrown everything down, the papers are everywhere. And, you know, it's me as an adult saying, you know, is everything all right? Are you all right? You look a little bit stressed. Do you need some help with anything? A tune in, you know, when you said, you know, oh, woke up out with my alarm, didn't go off. The milk was out of date. I couldn't even have a cup of coffee, got stuck in traffic. And me saying, oh, it's rubbish when that, I hate it when that happens. You know, oh, I'm imagining that was really rubbish. I'm imagining you feeling a little bit stressed and a little bit like you're not ready to go and teach the year 10s maths in 10 minutes, you know, and providing that containment, you know, being that supportive adult. What can I do to help? You know, might be a hand on your shoulder, regulating, right, okay, you go and get a cuppa. Do you need 5 minutes and I'll go and let the kids, you know, what can I do to help? Yeah. And when we see an adult like that, what we tend to want to do is go and help and support. And sometimes when we see children or young people behaving that way, if they arrive to the lesson and they're throwing their bag down or they've not sat down straight away, we don't always take that approach. And I think
you take it personally on your lesson, don't you? Like, absolutely. Oh, plan this lesson and they're disrupting it already. Rather than, like you say, whereas if a colleague had come in and done that, I'm literally back at school thinking about my colleagues coming in and feeling stressed and things that had happened on the way to school and stuff. And I would never have like been like, oh, you're disrupting my morning. Time to get ready for my lessons. I wouldn't have done that. I'd have been straight over and asking if they're all right. So we should be doing. I think the tricky thing is when it's happening with a lot of students at once as well, isn't it? Because it's not often just one pupil in the school, in your class, that's behaving in that way. And when you've got a few of them, it can be really difficult as the teacher to manage.
Yeah, and I think when you were just saying that bit, it's about in Thrive, we take like a non-judgmental stance. Yeah. And sometimes, especially with some of our younger children and older, you know, what might be absolutely the end of the world for them, it might be something tiny, like their pencil breaking, or, you know, something that in the grand scheme of things for you, you know, feels, you know, insignificant, but for them it's their whole world, you know, like social groups falling apart, argument, you know, that is absolutely for that child or young person in that moment the biggest catastrophic thing that could be happening. And it's taking that non-judgmental stance when we're approaching situations with children, young people.
Yeah, and likewise, you don't know what's been happening at home. You know, things with a crisis in particular, things are really bad for quite a lot of families, and you don't know what's been happening at home before they've managed to get themselves to school. You might have a young carer in your class. You might have, there's all sorts of things that could be going on that you might not be aware of.
Yeah.
Or you might, I suppose it's meeting them where they're at and remembering, not to judge, I suppose, when they first come in. we're way late, which is great. I love having a chat. But let me coming back to the isolation booths then. Is there any guidance on how, because we mentioned about some children spending full days in isolation booths. Sometimes I've known kids spending more than one day in the isolation booth after a period of time, you know, and they've done something significant in a lesson. I'm not going to, you know, hide that. Like something must have happened very significantly for them to be in an isolation booth. But is there any guidance on how long schools are allowed to keep children in an isolation booth? Is there any law on it?
I don't think there is, but I know of anyway. I know that schools will have their own policies in place, or you would like to hope so if they're using something like isolation booths or isolation. Guidance would be welcomed, I think, and definitely for me, a good idea, because what happens when there's not guidance is that people and schools don't have guidelines and parameters to work around. And what happens is it increases the likelihood of mistakes being made, errors. Yeah. You know, things not being used effectively because individuals have not got clear criteria and standards to follow. So typically, if there's not that guidance or policy, people are using it different in different ways. So I think, I think it would be welcomed to have some guidance and law around how we're using them.
Supposed to avoid inconsistency as well, because you're even going to get to school, aren't you, with inconsistency, different people using it more perhaps than others. So what's your opinion on them? I think we know what your opinion is, but I'm just going to ask you, what's your opinion on isolation booths? And are there any times when you think it would be appropriate to use isolation as a strategy?
So I'm not an advocate personally of isolation booths. And, you know, I think there are other ways of addressing behaviour and supporting children and people to adapt the behaviour. And like I said earlier, understand their feelings and understand why they might be behaving in a certain way, because if we don't do that with our children and people, what we're going to get is we're going to get adults that don't understand their feelings. And, you know, if no one teaches them, we're going to get adults that can't regulate and might still behave in certain ways. And there's very different consequences when we go out into the world that will happen to our young adults when they're outside of the, you know, the parameter of school. So it's really important that we use that, you know, when we teach our children and people how to regulate and understand feelings. And it's okay to feel certain ways, and it's not okay to behave, you know, in a certain way because of it. What can we do different if we're feeling like that? You know, and I'll say it again, behaviour is a communication of unmet need often. And without that attuned adult alongside, they struggle to understand that cause and effect. And again, it's back to that attunement, validation, containment, regulation. If anything, the adult needs to come closer in times like that and not, you know, not send to isolation or push away or let that child sit with that really big feeling on their own. Because as an adult, that would feel, you know, if you've got an overwhelming feeling and you know, you have to sit with it by yourself with no support or no one asking if you're all right or checking in, or that can be quite daunting and unhealthy. And it can lead to, like I say, a big impact on a child or young person's mental health.
Yeah. Are there any times when you do think it's a good idea?
For me, I would always say it's important for the adult to address with the child or young person. I think often when, if you know, like you said earlier, when you've got a busy classroom, if you've got 33 children on your own, you've got multiple needs to cater for. And if you've got a child who is dysregulated and is disrupting the classroom, if they were to be removed, of course, that's going to alleviate, you know, one of the problems in the classroom, and it might calm the class down. But that's only a short-term solution, you know, and it might need to be that child needs to be removed if they're being unsafe, or, you know, but it's who catches them at the other side. It's, you know, who's waiting for them in isolation, or who's that person who they're going to. And I think that's the thing that we need to look at. It's when they're going to isolation or to wherever they're going, if they're removed from the classroom, actually, where are they going to? You know, are they going to an adult who is trained and able to talk to them about what's happened and, you know, talk about, you know, if there's been an issue or a certain behaviour, if they've done something, you know, that's not acceptable. It's having that conversation and having an adult ready to help them regulate, because what children can't do if they're dysregulated, if they're heightened, they can't access the part of the brain that they're thinking. So if someone's trying to talk to them about, you know, why did you do that and what happened, it's almost like they can't hear and they can't have those conversations until they're calm and regulated. So it's having that person ready to catch them if they are, you know, sitting out of the classroom into isolation.
I think that's really important. I'm pleased you said that, because it is tricky when you're a classroom teacher. And I think if you're a classroom teacher listening and we're saying, oh no, you should never use isolation booths, you should never isolate a kid, it's hard. It's like, well, what do you do if they're dangerous? What do you do if this is happening in the class? And you've got to think about the others in the class as well. And it's not black and white, is it? Sometimes a child can't be in the classroom, it's not safe, something needs to change, but it's what happens next, isn't it? And that's sort of how, yeah, how the relationships are built, how we listen to the child, how we help that child, not just dismiss them and that be it. Something else, we need some more backup, we need something else happening. And I suppose teachers would argue there's not enough staff and there's not enough time and there's not enough funding, which is a bigger issue.
And there's lots of pressures in school. I've worked in schools for, like I said, 13 years, and it's tough, you know, being in schools, it's tough, you know, funding cuts, no budgets, increasing class sizes. It's tough, isn't it?
It really is. And there was an article in Schools Week that I had a look at, I think I shared the link with you, and with by Steve Garnett, and he says, as a classroom teacher, I want them. He's talking about isolation booths. I want them. I've worked in schools with and without them. Behaviour was always better in the former. So, what do you think?
It's back to that point of it can be tough in schools. And in like you said, often where if you don't have a teaching assistant or if you don't have a pastoral care team, or, you know, it can be difficult when it's just you in a classroom, when you're trying to hold, you know, lots of different needs, differentiation, you're trying to teach on top of everything else. And I think for me, I wasn't taught when I went to uni and college, that wasn't part of my training, you know, to how to support dysregulated children, and, you know, how to support a heightened child, how to support a bereaved child, how, you know, but yet all these things teachers are dealing with on a daily basis, you know, how to deal with children who've had severe trauma. That wasn't part of my training. And I think that's a big thing in schools, that lots of our teachers think that might be the only option, is isolation or, you know, removing them from the classroom because they don't know how to deal with certain behaviours or how to talk to children about difficult topics. Or and it's back to that point of, it'll be, you know, it's a temporary fix. It's a short term fix, you know, but it'll happen. It's likely to happen again the next session and the next session after that, because, you know, if the child or young person's not given any other strategies or coping strategies or, you know, regulation techniques, they're just going to keep doing the same pattern of behaviour. And it's getting to the bottom of that behaviour. So, you know, what are they trying to communicate? You know, what is it that might be going wrong for that child or young person to help them so that it doesn't happen again? I would say, you know, it can be a temporary fix to remove a child from a certain situation, but it's where they're going to, who's going to catch that, and what we're doing to help them, just as we would if they had, you know, if they were struggling to read and they needed a reading intervention, struggling to regulate and they're struggling to, you know, deal with certain situations, or, you know, if every time they're on the football pitch, they can't cope if another team scores, or if, you know, if they, you know, don't get the free kick, and every time they do that, becoming, you know, really dysregulated, they might be hurting other children, they might be kicking the goalpost, storming off. If no one's there to catch that and talk about that, validate, attune, contain, regulate, they're going to do it again and again and again, because nobody's taught them any other way of dealing with it different.
It's huge, isn't it? And it's really hard, and I can see both sides of this in some ways, but, you know, as a parent as well, I can definitely see that the thought of your own child being in that sort of situation is awful. Like, if someone wasn't helping them with their emotions in that situation, and they're not being in the lesson, it's so hard. There just needs to be a different way of thinking, almost, and a way of being able to meet everyone's need. I don't know, it's really hard. What about, because obviously our podcast is all about children with special educational needs, what about if we think about isolation booths for children with for children in the class who've got SEND? Are they going to be inappropriate for some children with SEND to be used? Is it inappropriate for isolation booths to be used for some children with SEND, and why?
Yeah, so I think students who've got additional needs might need additional, you know, provisions or changes in provisions. So they might need, you know, more regular brain breaks. They might need certain fidget toys or fidget chairs. They might struggle to sit still for long periods of time. So saying that they're expecting them to sit in silence on a seat with no sensory feedback whatsoever, often for, like you've just said, in some cases, really long periods of time, you know, is not going to be manageable or productive for them. And they're like, you know, they're likely to fail. You know, I've heard it called fail isolation, and then you have to do the whole thing over again. And actually, you know, they can't cope in that environment. And often don't, you know, if we've got children with SEND, they've, you know, they've got additional support plans, you know, individual education plans, often education healthcare plans, which means they need additional support and they need a tailored approach to meet their needs. And if we're not making reasonable adjustments, then, you know, we're arguably, we're not meeting the needs, because they do need something different to what some of the other students might need. And I think, you know, when we're sending, if we've got all children, not just children with SEN, but if we're sending children out or away from the classroom or send them to isolation, what we're doing is we're reinforcing to them that you don't belong here. You know, and we, you know, what we need to do is we need to create that sense of belonging. And, you know, when I come to school, I'm safe. This is where people understand me. You know, I feel like I belong here. And when you're constantly being sent out or sent to an isolation, because you're struggling, it kind of does reinforce that, oh, they don't want me here. I don't belong here. You know, I'm not like the others. And, you know, and again, it's back to that sense of guilt, shame that often lots of our children and people are sitting with and feeling, because it's reinforced by not being able to be in that classroom with their peers.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, for like reasons of children being sent to isolation booths as well, it, like, for children with SEND in particular, you know, if you've got like an autistic child, perhaps, who might have, may or may not have sensory differences, if they're being overwhelmed by like sensory input in the classroom and they can't manage it and feel overwhelmed and dysregulated, and then we're sending them away because of it, that's not fair.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Or the child with ADHD who, you know, might be sat there, and I'm being stereotypically, obviously everyone's different, but, you know, there could be a child with ADHD in a classroom who is physically unable to sit still for that period of time and can't, and then gets up or moves around and does something and then ends up in trouble because of it. It's not taking into account their needs.
No, and it's like you just said, every single child is unique and different. So what might work for one child, a young person, might not work for another. What it looks like for one child, a young person, might look different to another. And you're absolutely right. And if we're not doing that, then, you know, we're not doing our legal duty to meet the needs of all students. But like you say, those with SEN who've got additional needs that we need to support.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what are the alternatives? And this is the tricky bit. So for schools who are currently using isolation booths, but are thinking, you know, we would like to move away from them, I'm sure, like, no teacher wants to be sending a child to an isolation booth and them not to, and them be feeling that shame and feeling that way. Everybody goes into teaching in a way that they want to support children, and I can't imagine anybody wants that to happen. And you know, they're busy and they don't want to, they would love to be able to spend the time to have, build these relationships up. But realistically, when they've got full timetables and it's a busy school, what can they do instead?
So at Thrive, with our training, we train people to learn about why young children and young people might behave in certain ways, and understand kind of the underpinning theory and research behind it. And it provides strategies and knowledge on how to approach certain behaviours, what to do in certain situations, because like you say, like similarly, and you know, in my experience teaching years, like I've been in situations where you think, oh, I don't know how to deal with this behaviour. I'm not sure, because no one, you know, you kind of learn on the job, if you like. No one teaches you really. Well, I didn't get taught that in uni, what to do if, you know, a child is dysregulated or for throwing a chair across a classroom or if they're hurting somebody, you know, those kind of, or you can learn about it sometimes, but then when you're in it, it's kind of like, it's very different. So Thrive Training provides kind of the skills and strategies to handle, to help children and people to handle their emotions and self-regulate. And, you know, it gives them the strategies and skills, and it's helping people to have a different way of responding that will help bring down the stress and cortisol levels when children are dysregulated. And it's giving them the tools and the strategies and the techniques to be able to use in the classroom, or, you know, and using the profiling tool will highlight which students do have gaps. So, you know, like I was saying, you might have a 15-year-old that's working at a 6-month-old level for their social and emotional development. So it will highlight those students who need extra support, who might need one-to-one support, who might need a home action plan for parents to, you know, how they can support at home. So it gives you the tools that you need to be able to support children and young people.
Almost like a screener, sorry to interrupt, but is it almost like a, like you can screen the children so you know where they are developmentally, so you got like a developmental age almost for the kids and you?
Yeah, so it's a profiling tool, so it will give you a profile. So there's individual and group profiles, so you can screen classes, small groups, and also, like you say, from those classes, if you've got some children that come out really low, you can then do an individual profile that will give you individual strategies and activities to be able to use to support that child or young person with where they are, where they're working.
Yeah, because you'd never, like, just thinking about a 15-year-old who could be developmentally 6 months old, you would never dream of shouting at a baby for being dysregulated.
Absolutely. And if we
imagine if a baby was crying and was dysregulated for various different reasons and you shouted at the baby, that's, you know, it's child protection issue. You would never do that. But if a child who's 15 who's developmentally at that age and we are shouting, sending them to isolation, all of these, it's wrong.
Yeah. And, you know, if just from that example, if we've got a 6-month-old who's crying, you know, they're screaming, you know, what do? We pick them up. We contact, oh my goodness. Yeah. We rock them, you know, we regulate them, we pat them.
Yeah, you help them regulate.
And we do all, you know, validating, attuning, contact. We do all of that. But like you say, and obviously that will look very different to some of the. And what Thrive Online does is it gives you age appropriate strategies and activities.
It's obviously not going to pick the 15-year-old up.
Absolutely. So you know, you will always get strategies and activities that are relative to how old the student is and what will work. Yeah. And again, like, staff know their children inside, they know them better than anybody. So they might look and think that's going to work for that student. Oh, that might not work for that student. I might need to tweak it a little bit. But yeah, it just gives you the skills, because we can't expect that through isolation, children are going to be able to alter their behaviour. Yeah. You know, they can't reflect back and change their behaviour if they can't see the correlation between cause and effect, if they can't problem solve. They need that adult to be able to help them to do that.
Yeah, because young children might not be able to make the connection with why they've even been sent to isolation. If I'm just thinking developmentally, if you've got teenagers who are developmentally like toddler age or 3-4 year old sort of developmentally, they're not able to make the connection between I've been sent to isolation because of this thing I've done. It might not, the two might not meet. So it might be completely pointless. You're just taking the problem away from the classroom to make it easier, and safer for the children, and, you know, fair for the kids that want to learn and are trying to learn. Well, they all want to learn, but you know what I mean? The ones that are trying their best to get on with the lesson and might not be feeling dysregulated. Yeah. But you're not actually helping that child. It's so interesting. And so I suppose your point of view is trying to sort something out before you even get to the stage of needing an isolation booth is sort of to understand the children better, work out where they are developmentally, think of strategies, understand child development a little bit more, which as secondary teachers you're not really taught. Yeah, all of that sort of stuff beforehand. So then when they're less likely to need anything else.
Yeah, and also when, you know, because that's a human nature, people do get dysregulated, and like, it's knowing what to do and how, and having things in place. So, you know, teachers are amazing. You know, like, teachers are, I work in schools, I'm a teacher, you know, and all the things they have to hold in one, you know, there's a lot. I think they are amazing. And it's having, you know, it's working with your team, with your senior leaders to put, you know, policy and practice in place. If you've got a young person that is regularly dysregulated or disrupt, you know, what does that look like? Because, you know, like you say, if you're on your own with, you know, a large group, what does that look like? What policies are in place? You know, what is the strategies? What, you know, who do we need? You know, do we need somebody else for support sometimes? You know, might we need a teaching assistant? Or, you know, and it's looking at the wider team and putting something in place to support you, that young person, and the other children in the classroom as well. Yeah, so very much around policy and practice and what it looks like for your school.
Yeah, and so if we think about, I know we've spoken specifically about isolation booths, but isolation in general. So longer term, how can behaviour policies ensure that learners are kept safe without them needing to? So is it these strategies then, would you say, these strategies that we're putting in place, understanding the children, what can we, yeah, how can behaviour policies ensure that these learners are kept safe and don't need to be isolated?
So in Thrive, we talk about having relational policies. So one of the, I think you'll have got from me today, but one of the core principles of Thrive Approach is the adult-child relationship, which is vital when developing children and young people's, you know, social and emotional skills that are essential for life and learning. So it's really looking at, how do we build those relationships? What does that look like? Do we put an importance on relationship, you know, getting the relationship right first, building those relationships? In Thrive, we teach that all children need to have the experience of an adult providing them with a secure base and calming them when they're dysregulated, you know, to build that trust and knowing that actually, you know, You know, Miss Durant is my teacher and she'll keep me safe even when I'm wobbly, even when I've got these big feelings and I'm dysregulating. She, you know, she's here to keep me safe. And we call that being a co-regulator, because we're meeting their needs when they're being dysregulated. And when children experience safety in their relationships, they open up to new learning, and they're more able to be able to, you know, look at, you know, what might we do next time and talk about that. Whereas if they're met with, you know, not that relationship, or they're met with, you know, being sent to isolation, or, you know, that silence, that expectation of, you know, we're sitting, we're not talking, you're getting on with your work, that kind of shuts down that relationship and that safety. Because again, what we're reinforcing is, you know, you don't belong, or there's not someone here to help me when I've got this really overwhelming feeling. I'm expected to sit here in silence and not, you know, talk to anybody. So yeah, it can be tricky. And I think for any policy, or, you know, whether it's a behaviour policy, relational, whatever, I think it's about the staff understanding that policy and knowing that policy, and leaders following through with that. And if, you know, if we're putting in place, I don't know, extra support or certain plans around certain children, that everyone's aware of that and everyone's, you know, coming at it from the same point of view, we're all using the same strategies, you know, the same activities together, that's really important that everyone's aware of that. And we're all following the same.
Yeah. I think the only thing that people say often when you say about relationships, and that the import, which I agree, relationships are very, very important, and is if you're a teacher and you're teaching hundreds of children in a week, how on earth, and it, you know, you do develop relationships with the children as they go on, but in the first few weeks, how on earth can you possibly have these relationships, good enough relationships to help with dysregulation, etc., when you're teaching hundreds of children?
Yeah. You're right, and it, you know, it can be like you say, you might see one child, you might only see them once every fortnight, because that's
exactly like if you've got a fortnightly timetable, you might be seeing them once a fortnight. How do you, and like, obviously if the teachers want to develop these relationships with them, but it's physically impossible to do it with so many, to build relationships, get to know so many children so quickly when you're trying to teach them, you know, the curriculum pressures, you're trying to get everything covered. How do you do that?
and you're right, and obviously every school and provision is different. I know in my experience, when we, not just coming from like year 6 to year 7 or whichever transition year group, if we're just coming into a new school, but also between year groups, the first kind of 2 weeks is very much kind of, I don't want to say curriculum on hold, I don't mean that, but it's much, the first 2 weeks is very much around building relationships, getting to know the students as well as you can when you might only see that class once a week, or, you know, once a fortnight. You know, getting to know them, you know, having that relationship with them. You know, when you think back, when I certainly think back to my school days, I remember the teachers that were funny, kind, smile, you know, they're the ones that, you know, I remember because they had, you know, in relationship with us, and they made me feel safe, happy at school. You know, they're the connections that you remember. So I would say, you know, if you're a senior leader, kind of pushing that agenda of making time for that, because it's really important, and actually it'll have such an effect longer term, because you've got those relationships, you understand the children a little bit more, you've got that knowledge about them, so that, you know, you can use that, and children feel safe, they feel that, like, you're investing in them, like they belong. That's really important. You know, safety is the number one, you know, the number one underlying feature that they need. You know, they need to feel safe before they can then move on to do anything else.
Even though it feels like you're missing out on the time for the curriculum and it's so tight and you've got to get all of this stuff fit in a sense, it's a good thing, because if you get the relationships right first, then you can whiz through the curriculum afterwards, can't you? Because you're not going to get children disrupting the learning's not going to be disrupted as much if the relationships are there first and children are able to learn. So I suppose it does make sense, but yeah, I can see sometimes being hit with a bit of resistance when you've got trying to get through loads of stuff. And
yeah, absolutely. And it can be little, you know, I always watch on, you know, social media and things now, and you see kind of teachers doing different welcomes, and, you know, and it can just, you know, things like that, like, you know, and I appreciate it's difficult, like I say, when you've got such a huge number of students, but it's, you know, trying to remember, you know, just as they're walking in the classroom, oh, you've done your head, it looks lovely, that hair, you know, like, And just right. little things like that. And, you know, how was your mum after the weekend? Oh, you know, so, you know, asking about their family, just as they're walking in the classroom. So it's not eating in, you know, because it's so busy and you've got so much to pack into a 1 hour, you know, science lesson or English lesson. And it's just those little bits that make them think, they remember, they note it, she noticed.
Yeah.
You know, things like that make such an adult that, you know, is, makes me think, oh, you know, Georgina remembered about, you know, she remembered
Yeah.
to ask me about my holiday or how my gran was doing, or she noticed I'd had my hair cut. And, you know, little things like that make such a difference. And again, just build those positive relationships and help children to feel safe within your lesson.
Yeah, you're right. And it's like walking down the corridor, isn't it, in between, you know, break time, maybe stopping and saying, oh, how is your pet dog today? And is your puppy not settled in the mornings? Or, you know, anything, like just trying to remember, like you do when you're trying to build a relationship with an adult and you're trying to make friends with someone, you remember what they've told you, and then you bring it up another time with them, don't you? And then they think, oh, brilliant, she's remembered that I like so-and-so and that I like whatever. And then, yeah, it helps to build a relationship. I suppose it's not massive things, really, is it? It's just like little
showing that you know that my
showing an
teacher
interest.
is, you know, and you know, if, you know, she's remembered, she must care, and showing that interest, and like you say, just for that short little bit as they're walking or leaving the classroom, or can make all the difference.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. You've given such brilliant advice. It's been really, really useful. Do give us some links then, because I know we've got, and I'll put the link to the previous podcast we did with Thrive. So if you're listening to the podcast, if probably listen on your phone, if you scroll down or on your computer, scroll down, you'll see the links below. If you're watching on YouTube, they'll be down here. So I'll put the link to the previous episode we had with Thrive, and I'll put some links from Twinkle as well. But what would you like us to link to as well?
So I'll link the Thrive Approach website, and on there is some other Thrive in Action events that we've done that you could that people can watch. There's information about our training, a little bit more about what we do. So yeah, there's lots of things on there for people to have a look at. So I'll post the link after this.
Brilliant. Thanks ever so much. It's been fantastic. Wasn't she brilliant? Such great advice. I really enjoyed that one. I'm sure it'll be just as popular as our previous Thrive episode, which you can also listen to if you look at the link in the show notes, as well as some of the Twinkle resources that you can have a look at that link to this episode. And make sure if you're listening, you're subscribed to our channel, and if you're watching over on YouTube, you've subscribed on there too. It's all free, so do make sure you take advantage of that. And thanks again for listening to Sending the Experts with me, Georgina Durrant. I'll see you next time.